Hello, and welcome to The Calling. This is our first episode. I'm Andrew Boyer, and I'm here with Marek Zabriskie. And what are we doing here, Marek?
Good question, Andrew. We are beginning a process where we're going to be engaging really interesting people and pondering the meaning of life and decision-making and how to make decisions and explore this great journey of life that we're all on in a way that brings about fulfillment because we align our gifts and talents with what God's calling us to do in the world in all sorts of different spheres, not just religious spheres, but in law, medicine, in this case, in the sphere of serving in the military and how important that is to our nation and our world. So we're so thrilled to have Mike Hayes with us today. Mike has lived a kind of a life of once-in-a-lifetime experiences already with 11 tours of duty and then some. He's a former commanding officer of SEAL Team 2, leading a 2,000 Special Ops Task Force in Afghanistan. He has a Bronze Star for valor in combat in Iraq, a Bronze Star for Afghanistan, and the Defense Superior Service Medal from the White House. In addition to a 20-year career as a SEAL, Mike was a White House Fellow. He served for 2 years as Director of Defense Policy and Strategy at the National Security Council and worked under both Presidents George W. Bush and Barack Obama. He's been held up at gunpoint and threatened with execution. He's jumped out of a building rig to explode. He's helped amputate a teammate's leg and made countless split-second life and death decisions. He's currently the Chief Digital Transformation Officer at VMware and leading the company's worldwide business operations. Mike was also Chief of Staff and COO at Bridgewater Associates. He holds an MA in public policy from Harvard and his BA from Holy Cross.
Thank you so much for having me, and like you said, taking a moment to reflect on this being the 21st anniversary of 9/11. So many great Americans have gone before us, not just on that day, but in service to the great nation. So it is a special day to be here, and I appreciate both of you.
Maybe we begin, Mike, by saying, where were you on that day, and what happened? How did that impact you as a person?
Well, Marek, I think what's really important in life is to have humility, and I will tell you that while my SEAL training class started with 120 guys and 19 graduated, I was really challenged by pull-ups. I'm 6'4", 235 pounds, and that day, right at the moment, I was literally doing pull-ups at SEAL Team 8, and that's when I found out that the first tower went down. So, I was moved incredibly, as every American was at the time, and also wildly under-recognizing how much that would change the trajectory and focus of not only the nation, but of my personal career.
So what was that first deployment that came your way out of that?
Well, the SEALs picked up the pace significantly right after 9/11. For me personally, I was actually in Germany and part of the plan to move into Iraq. And so 9/11, as you will recall, caused us to simultaneously focus on Afghanistan with Iraq. So I would really say that the thing that impacted me the most from Afghanistan was well after 9/11. I didn't personally go to Afghanistan until about, I think, 2010, actually. And in 2012, I spent 10 months there as the commanding officer of, as you noted, the Special Operations Task Force, and ran not just SEALs, but everything that we did in the southeast part of the country for special operations.
Can you tell us a little bit about the differences between serving in Iraq and serving in Afghanistan? We've read so much about both, but I imagine they're very, very different.
They are different. The similarities are very simple. We're trying to stop bad people from doing bad things to good people, you know. And the differences are stark. The differences could be on geography. You can answer that question with the geographic differences and the way the people live, the culture, et cetera. But really, I would honestly emphasize that there are more commonalities than there were differences between Iraq and Afghanistan.
Let's roll back for a minute and just how did you end up becoming a Navy SEAL? And wasn't there an Ignatian spiritual retreat that you went on that played a part in that decision making?
Yeah, in 1993, I graduated from Holy Cross. But before graduating, I was really fortunate. I was tapped on the shoulder by Father Michael Ford, who later married myself and my beautiful wife, Anita, goes by Nee. And But at the time, he said, "Hey, Mike, you know, I noticed that you haven't done the 1 week spiritual exercises yet. And while it's not mandatory, it's highly encouraged." And so, going into my senior year, I took a week of my 4 week break at Christmas and went and didn't talk to anybody and just followed this very, very deep and spiritual journey. And it was a series of readings and actually talks to us, but as many people know, you don't talk at all for that week. And so it was a period of reflection and introspection that ultimately led me after prayer as well to choose to become a Navy SEAL.
Now, the training for being a SEAL is probably the most intense of any of our military services. Can you tell us a little bit about what that was like and how does one survive, you know, through it both physically? And in your book, you point out the greater challenge was actually the mental one.
Yeah, Merrick, great question. You know, SEAL training for me was 120 guys starting in my class and then 19 graduating 6 months later. The fifth week of training is called Hell Week, where you're up for a week straight, literally from Sunday morning until Friday afternoon. You're running around with boats on your head. It's lots of cold water, obstacle courses, long swims, just everything that the instructors can possibly do to bring the trainees to the point of what they think the point of failure is, and then further. And what comes of that is you actually learn how to stretch your limits. You know, certainly a lot of guys quit, but the guys who make it through really understand not just how their limits can be stretched time and time again with different experiences, but also, and perhaps more importantly, how to act and react and think and how to treat others when we are very, very uncomfortable. Life's super easy when we're comfortable. When we're uncomfortable, that's when we could see deviations from our morals, our ethics, or even the law. And because we're miserable and we think we have an excuse to go do something poorly, but actually, you know, in life, that's where the opportunities are. That's where we have the opportunity to step forward and prove at least to ourselves what we're made of and what our characters and our values are and how we can ultimately give to others and make the nation and world a better place.
So one of those situations where you were really tested to put all this into work was when you were taken at gunpoint down in Peru. Could you tell a little bit about that story and then how your training played into the decisions you made there and how we might think in our own lives when I go from a really calm situation to something where I'm under intense stress, how we might function in that setting?
Yeah, absolutely. So for context, in 1996, I was on my first SEAL deployment in South America. And this particular event was in Lima, Peru. And myself and my buddy, Ken, were simply out getting dinner. I wish it was a cooler story than that, but we were unarmed. We were coming back from dinner. We were pulled over by two police cars that were, they were police cars, but they were terrorists who jumped out of the police cars and ultimately, you know, jammed us in the head with weapons and threatened us with execution and a whole lot of other bad things. And, you know, the lessons that you asked about, I would say number one is being calm. There's a saying that I started really trying to proliferate after that, which is calm breeds calm. Excitement breeds excitement. And so I think what's really important is to remain calm in these hard situations, because that's how you ultimately have the best chance of succeeding in these hard situations. In this particular situation, you know, I just said in fluent in Spanish, and I just said, look, we're desk workers. We know the deal. You get the car and we go on our merry way. And you know, we weren't a threat to these terrorists. And ultimately, through some quick thinking, we were able to survive. What I will say, though, is one other special kind of set of thinking in that was that I was engaged to Nia at the time. And, you know, what you think about is that what I thought about was that I'm not afraid to die. What I was afraid about was her not knowing how much I loved her, or her maybe not even knowing what happened to me, and the fear of not having enough impact in the world, or really boils down to the relationships we have, And I will say that I had all those thoughts, but I don't know if that was 6 seconds or 60 seconds, but it wasn't longer than that because really you're just trying to stay alive in the moment.
Yeah. You know, when I read that story in your book, Never Enough, you kept, as you read it, you started to feel like any minute now this is going to turn into sort of a Jason Bourne, you know, where I took out this guy and I knocked that guy out. And because it was you and your friend or your partner. And so you're kind of waiting for that. And then what it turned out was that, like, the way you survived it was to do none of that. And I thought that was really quite interesting because it wasn't the kind of story that you expected maybe in a Navy SEAL book. Yeah. But it was, in a way, I think, more instructive.
Yeah, I mean, I'll try not to do a spoiler alert here for everybody who's listening. I certainly would appreciate going to buy the book. I donate all the profits to a charity I started that pays off mortgages for Gold Star families. Those are families who've lost their service member, mostly husband and dad. But the way I started the book was about a story in Iraq in 2007 on a really, really hard mission when my friend Josh and I didn't kill someone, which is a very, like you said, it's a very counter narrative to what one may expect. But I think a lot of learning and what's really important, and I think one theme that you'll see is from people who've actually been in combat, they generally aspire to help others and live a life where you don't need to go back to combat, that where nations can be peaceful and thrive and ultimately help each other and pull the world up.
The one time where you had to, many times actually, but one situation took place actually in the Situation Room at the White House where you were serving, is when the ship captain was taken hostage, and Tom Hanks played in that incredible movie about it, and you were the point person to try to figure out how we save his life. Could you tell us a little bit about that and the decision-making process that goes into something like that?
Absolutely. I was very fortunate to be selected for a program called the White House Fellowship. I was a White House Fellow in 2008, joined the last 6 months of the Bush administration, had a fabulous time with that team, and then was one of the few people who lived through to the next administration because I was not a political appointee. And in the beginning of the Obama administration, early 2009, this gentleman, Richard Phillips, was hijacked, and we just described the situation where I was hijacked in 1996. So here the current story is 2009. I know what it's like to be him, and then more importantly, it wasn't a hard math problem to see that you have terrorists in Somalia who would love to have an American, and they have money. You've also got pirates who've captured this guy, Richard Phillips. It's who are incentivized by money. And so we would have been in a very bad situation as a nation and not start President Obama's administration off on a good foot if we were to have Captain Phillips get into the hands of terrorists. And so the short version is we did everything that we could to avoid that. We were successful. And one of my coolest keepsakes is a really nice note on White House stationery that says, Mike, you made a family very happy on Easter. Thanks for the great job on the Somalia situation. Barack.
Wow. Something else. Now, we're in Greenwich, Connecticut. A lot of people here make their living on Wall Street. They commute back and forth. COVID had a huge impact on that. People just work remotely, but now they're being often required to go back in the office on a regular basis. Sometimes those days are incredibly intense. They come home and they're trying to re-engage with their family, or they've been traveling all across the country or around the world and re-engage. My own wife practices law in another city. We commute. We see each other every other weekend and reengage. But you went on, I think, 7 tours of duty for 6 months apart from me and your daughter, and would come back and reengage from an incredibly intense life where you're making life or death decisions all day long and bombs are going off at times, etc. What was it like for the three of you to reengage and come back and be a kind of all-American dad of helping to raise your daughter and just be the spouse that Nee needs, having been away so long and where she's being solo as a parent? What was that like for you?
Great question. I think really honestly, the perspectives of the spouses are much more important than on that question. The military spouses are such an unsung group of heroes. The military folks just get up, go overseas, and start focusing on things outside the nation. But what really happens is People like me and my daughter are back home actually not knowing what's happening. And so I'm taking risk and assuming risk that is only worth assuming. But the spouses at home don't necessarily know that. And they don't. And so there's a sense of stress and on families that candidly I didn't fully recognize and appreciate until I was finished with my 20-year career. Now your question was around kind of the integration back as a family unit when you come together. First of all, when I think you have great characters and values and faith, and you're built on all of the things that are right and good, then that's what's the most important. And that said, you also get into a rhythm as a family where, for example, Nee was completely independent and didn't need me at home, you know. And so when I come home and I'm like, getting into a new rhythm or whatnot, you know, I think the people who aspire to be the all-American dad can probably throw off the spouse's rhythms at times or be challenging, or, you know, you referred a little bit to the hard day that people come home from Wall Street on. It's all the same thing. What's most importantly is, how do you have that calmness and the tranquility and the recognition and humility and try to pull others up? Sometimes I'm successful at it and sometimes less so. But like we said before, is just really focusing on patience and readjusting back into the new life. I can't tell you enough that it is a very hard thing to do for military families.
Now, the whole nation, I hope and believe, is behind our military. We're all blessed to have a great, great military. But there's been so much division in our nation. Do you have any words of wisdom for how we as a nation can stop viewing ourselves as red and blue, Republican, Democrat, us against them, enemy of the people, the craziness that we've seen, and kind of come together more as the American people?
Yeah, that's a great question. I love to talk about this. The most important thing is to start with what is the visions and the goals for the nation. The what is way more important than the how. And I think it's hard to disagree that the what is a peaceful and prosperous nation where we can all thrive. And then importantly, we can all have our different views and celebrate different views and respect different views. To make it real, let me think of a quick issue. Kneeling for the American anthem. Like, people have very different views on that. And what I'll say is, while I personally would never kneel for the American anthem, the national anthem, I am somebody who fought overseas so that everybody can do what they want and have freedom of the press, freedom of expression, and have their own views. So, you know, I might be at a game, and while I personally wouldn't do that, I certainly see people doing that and say to myself, hey, that's the choice that I fought for, and the nation has to be built on a fabric of choice. And so respecting that others have different opinions and viewpoints toward things is what the foundation of this great nation is. And what we need to do is not get so polarized and not respect people who have different views. By all means, through peaceful and great means, go push your views out into the world, but at the same time, recognize that there are a lot of great people who have views different than you. And if we can figure out how that all works together, that's what will make the nation stronger. Our nation's forefathers made this great nation so that we have different views. And while we might kind of bump our way down the highway, sometimes left, sometimes right, we aren't supposed to go off the road. And so that's ultimately is we're at a time now where I think if we can all take a deep breath and have that open-mindedness and the humility and the push, then we can keep the proverbial car on the road and keep increasing our ability to be such a great nation.
Now, Mike, you kind of came to us through our parishioner, Rich Malik, who serves with you in the Whitehead Bible Study. John Whitehead was the former CEO, as you know better than I do, of Goldman Sachs, and he was a person of great faith and a really devout Episcopalian. He once told me, I was on a board with him years ago, that had an Episcopal priest ever said to him, John, you would make a great priest, he probably would have done that with his life. But John went on to serve in Washington. He served brilliantly at Goldman Sachs, and I get the sense that you and Rich and every member of that Whitehead Bible Study lead lives dedicated to service. If anyone's listening who's thinking about where they go with their life and how they use their gifts and talents, what would you tell them in terms of having a life of service? Because I think that's where we find our greatest joy and our greatest sense of meaning.
Yeah, Mark, another great question. And I would say that sometimes people say thank you for your service, and they think service is just service members who wear a uniform. That could not be more false. All 330 million Americans and everybody on this great planet has an incredible opportunity and calling to serve. You know, the most important thing is figuring out how. Sure, while I served in uniform, that's certainly one great way to serve. But I would say just try things on. Is it helping build a new forest? Is it putting clothes or food on the tables for the poor? Is it mentoring youth? There could be a million different ways to serve this great nation. My push would be for everybody to be able to answer that question and say, how do you serve? The thing is, we have to own the nation. Right now, we tend to think that service is something that somebody else does. And the concept of ownership of this great nation has to be put more front and center. And so, the what is service, the how is up to the individual.
Mike, since February, we've all been riveted with watching what's going on in the Ukraine with Russia's invasion, which they call a special military operation. I believe from everything I've read, they really thought they could go in and put a new government in place in a matter of days and kind of take control of the country, but that hasn't been the case. Have you been surprised with all the things you've seen from your life as a Navy SEAL and in the Situation Room and your work in the White House? Have you been surprised for how it's played out, and where do you think we're going to go from here?
Well, another great question. I have not been surprised to see what people will do when you take away their freedom, their justice, their prosperity, and their sense of nation. When people's backs are against the wall, they can really rally. You talked before about the polarized nation that we are. Well, you know, we're very fortunate. We don't have a common enemy right now. And I guarantee you, if this nation was ever attacked like it was 21 years ago, you will quickly rally and see that any sort of divisions go away. The Ukrainians right now have a common enemy, and they are very, very determined. And frankly, I think that anytime you see, we all want good to prosper over evil. The thing that I would say is that I've been asked, or actually a lot of us have seen footage of, Ukrainian drones dropping, bombs on Russian tanks. And there can be a little bit of a sense of, oh, good, the good guys are winning. What I would say is actually different. It's ultimately there's some 18-year-old Russian kid sitting in that tank getting bombed who really doesn't want to be there. And what we're really doing is living right now through a period of conflict that doesn't have to happen. And so as somebody who's seen way more conflict than I wish I have, what that leads to is a drive and a desire to not have conflict. So I can certainly cheer for the good over evil, but what I really cheer for is to not have to.
Mike, since 2001, we've heard about so many soldiers, men and women coming back who've taken their own lives. And it's agonizing to read about these stories. And can you shed a little light in why you think this has happened and how the military's responded and how we can support people who've come back from these really horrific situations at times and are trying to function and just it looks so hopeless to them?
Thank you for asking. I've lost plenty of teammates to suicide. I'm somebody who's buried about 70 friends over the years, as all SEALs have. And many of those teammates have died by suicide, and some of them are people we never, ever, ever would have even seen it coming. So that's given me a bit of perspective. What I would say first is to not be afraid to be intrusive in people's lives. We usually hear intrusive as a bad word, as a negative word. But if we're comfortable being intrusive and asking the hard questions when we see people being challenged, and it doesn't just have to be in the military with PTS, but just more generally saying, how are you doing, and actually listening. And when people need help, get them help. Out of every 100 times I ask somebody now, have you ever considered harm to self? That's a really awkward question to ask. One that when I was younger, I was much less inclined to ask. But you know, now out of every 100 times that I've asked it, probably 99 times I get somebody who answers in a way that I feel awkward that I even asked. But the 99 awkwards I will take, because I'll get one person who says, yes, I've considered that. And if I have to pay 99 awkwards for to help the one yes, then absolutely. So, you know, and I'll say also, that's why I wrote the book Never Enough. I donate all of my profits to a 501c3, a charity I started that pays off mortgages for Gold Star families. Those are families of fallen SEALs, of fallen service members. So women and children who don't have a husband and a father anymore due to either direct combat, but many of them dying by suicide as well. And so I do appreciate actually anybody listening to Google Never Enough and pick up your copy, of course. And again, know that I don't make a penny on it. It all goes to charity, but thank you for asking.
Yeah, I will say that you just gave this speech here at the church, and people were in the back, and everybody stayed for almost the entire hour. And some of the folks said, that's pretty unusual. You really had the crowd going, and I think ran out of books. So I think you've done just a terrific job with the book.
And Mike, can you tell us a little bit about your SEAL swim partner? He's a distinguished public servant who became an astronaut and one of the first on the space station. He received the Medal of Honor.
My swim buddy from SEAL training's name is Chris Cassidy. Chris is a great American. We are in SEAL training backing up for a second here. What happens is when the 120 guys all showed up, they threw us in the pool and just said, swim something like 20 laps as fast as you can. It was like 800 meters or 800 yards. I can't remember. But then they just pair off. The first two people were swim pair one. The numbers three and four were swim pair two, and so on. Chris and I were swim pair one. And so we've done miles and miles and miles of swims and dives and at night and in cold water. And Chris is simply as good as they come. Chris, at about year, I want to say 10 or 12, pivoted his career and applied for the astronaut program. He became an astronaut and flew the second to last space shuttle and then two subsequent deployments to the International Space Station. Chris is now the CEO of the Medal of Honor Museum. Chris himself does not have a Medal of Honor. He's got a lot of other recognitions and accolades, but the nation has right now 64 living Medal of Honor recipients, about 3,500 of all time since its inception in the 1860s. And the nation does not have a museum to recognize these heroes. We are on a mission to inspire America. We've raised about $170 million, and we're building it right next to AT&T Stadium, next to the Dallas Cowboys, and have an incredible board. And the goal isn't a museum to simply recognize the nation's Medal of Honor recipients. It's actually to extract their values and the characters from their stories so that we can inspire the third grader who sees bullying on the schoolyard to step in and stop it, or to really say, what are American values? What are global values? And how should we be as a nation? So Nee and I were really fortunate to be at the groundbreaking ceremony back on March 25th, Medal of Honor Day. The museum will open in a little over a year, and it's just going to be a super, super cool thing down in right next to the Dallas Cowboys Stadium.
You've spoken about character several times, and I think it's absolutely crucial to the life of every person on this planet. Who helped to instill character in you, and how can we instill that in others to make sure we're making the right choices to never, ever tell a lie, to do the right thing in every situation, if at all possible, to respect every, you know, we say this in our baptismal creed, and we did this today in the baptismal covenant, to respect the dignity of every human being. Who instilled this in you, and how can we kind of live this out and instill it in others?
Thank you. Easy answer for me. My grandfather, retired Navy Captain Edward Hayes, was Naval Academy class of 1940. He was at Pearl Harbor on December 7th, 1941 on the USS Maryland, He woke up on Sunday morning after, you know, from a good Irish Catholic family. He was hungover on Sunday morning and had a hard decision to make. Does he go into the chaos in the gunfire and the madness, or does he stay safe where he is? He commandeered a Jeep, made it onto the USS Maryland for the second wave of attacks that were just creating chaos all around him, and then just continued to live a life of service himself. I was really fortunate to grow up with my grandfather as my hero, and I've got a million stories that I could tell, but instead what I'd say is buy the book and you'll get a couple stories about him.
I want to wind it up by asking you a little bit about your faith. You began in an Ignatian spiritual retreat, which helped you focus on, I want to be a SEAL. And there are other times where you're in very intense situations where your faith played out and helped you, and it continues to. Could you give us just a little window into how that plays out in your life and how we can be up our own game of faith, so to speak?
Absolutely. Another thing that I could talk for hours about, I think the best way to say it is faith gives us comfort and allows us to take risk. You know, in life, when we have two paths in front of us, the harder path and the easier path, you know, a lot of times we don't take the harder path because we're not sure what will happen. What faith does is it actually lets you know that if you take the hard path and have anything less than what is classically judged as success, lets you know that you're not going to fail. You know, what faith really does is it helps you know that no matter what happens, you're going to be okay. When I speak to, you know, high schools or young professionals, I like to emphasize that, you know, success is certainly one path. And then to really figure out if something's failure, you can't just say, well, is failure failure? You have to ask one more question. You have to say, did you learn? If you failed and learned, you succeeded. And so faith helps us to either succeed or fail and learn.
That's great. Mike, it's been such an honor to spend time with you. Thank you for coming to Christ Church Greenwich and sharing an incredibly powerful message in our Sunday forum. And we wish you Godspeed in whatever endeavors you move forward in life. I think you've got us off to a great start with this podcast and helped us think about meaning, calling, service, things that are so essential to every human life. God bless you.
God bless you both. Thank you so much. And thanks again for being here.